Thanks, Steve. Okay, can you guys all hear me in the back? Okay. I'm going to sit. I sort of tweaked my back the other day, and so when I'm standing, I'm like grinding. So bear with me if you can. I am sort of the design guy and the fixture guy and the display guy who works across all industries. And so in my career, I think I've done 3 brewery stores. And we'll get into the reasons for that probably later, but it's either people just aren't interested or there's some other design guy out there who's doing a ton of them or something. But, you know, over the years, my client base really ranges wildly, you know, and Steve mentioned some of those. But at any given time, you know, like right now, this second, I think I've got, we just finished the Washington National store in D.C., and I've got a cowboy store, a surf shop, a women's clothing store, a pornography store, a camera store. I mean, pretty wide. And the principles are all sort of the same, you know. And I'd like to say a lot of this was handed down to me by my relatives, but, you know, the fact is, you know, Grandpa was in the store fixture business, and he was a manufacturer. He made the coconuts that went in the coconut grove, and I can remember him being 85 years old and driving around in his big Cadillac with this big case that was full of Christmas displays. And Dad went to work with him and sold store fixtures, as did his brother. And I, of course, went to law school and became a lawyer and was the black sheep of the family for a while. And about 81, I got into the store fixture business, bought a company here in San Diego. And through the years, I've sort of watched retail evolve, you know, and in particular, the last, you know, call it, what, 10, 15 years since e-commerce has stepped in, it's really radically changed things for everybody. And it's become sort of more important that everybody does everything right, you know. And so if you're the only game in town with a product that nobody else has, that everybody wants, you're gold, no problem. But guaranteed, somebody's going to come along and knock you out of the box. And it's usually sort of a blindside, you know. And I'll never forget this one client I had who came into town. He was from Germany. He was really smart, nice guy. And he was a diver. And he wanted to do the best dive shop in San Diego at a time when most of the people who owned dive shops were really just divers. They weren't retailers. And so we built a store in Pacific Beach, not far from here, you know, that had aquariums and it had, you know, modern displays and it had videos playing, and people just flocked this store. And he did so well, we opened 3 more, one which was really big. And along came this big sporting goods company called Sport Chalet. And they built a pool in their store so that you could watch them learn how to dive. And he got creamed, and came back into my office and was sitting at my house, actually, sort of saying, what are we going to do now? You know, and we had to reinvent his business into more of a travel business, which Sport Chalet wasn't doing. And so he just got blindsided. And that can sort of happen. You know, you guys are lucky in the sense that you've got a business where you can breed and develop customer loyalty, I think. You know, and I've worked with Northern Brewery a bit, and I worked with Ballast here in town, and I've visited most of the brewery shops around town. And the one thing that I noticed more than anything else was the customer service was great. I mean, the people were really enthusiastic. I mean, it was fun to walk into the stores, particularly for me, who knows enough about brewing beer to fill a thimble, right? But they were all helpful. I mean, the stores needed work in one way or another, and I think I'm here today to kind of talk to you about that in generalities. I can't necessarily tell you exactly what to do with each product that you have. What I'm going to talk to you about is generally what you do with all stores, and in some cases in particular, your type of store, to make the store sing a little bit more than it is now. And the goal really is to make the stores look better and to sell more and to retain customers for longer. And so in order to do that, you've got to take it, for me at least, in sort of a systemic manner. Most of my clients fall into one of a couple of categories. They're either really experienced and they are simply saying to me, here's what I want to do, I need somebody to draw it up. And I just sit back and listen and try to collaboratively work with them to achieve what they're after. 2, I have people who are getting into some kind of a franchise or a clothing store or something. They really just don't like their job and are trying to build a new business. And 3, I have what are called enthusiastic enthusiasts. The diver who loves diving and wants a dive shop. The surfer who loves surfing and wants a surf shop. The chemist, lawyer, teacher who really hates what they're doing but loves making beer. And they want to open up a beer shop. Okay, they're enthusiastic enthusiasts, which means they're probably not retailers to begin with. And so they've got to learn a bunch of different tracks. how to be a retailer, what to buy, what to sell it for, how to sell it, and so forth. And part of that is the store design part. And from what I have seen, as far as the people that have hired me to help them design their stores, most of them don't follow the store design track, right? So what I'm going to try to do today is tell you things you can do and reasons why you may or may not hire a designer and what it costs and so on and so forth. The most common refrain I get from people when they come to me is I'll say, look, what do you want to spend and what do you want it to look like? And they all wave their hands around and go, I want it to look like an Apple store. It doesn't matter if they're selling bikinis or if they're selling beer, they all want it to look like an Apple store, right? And what they're really saying is, the Apple stores are really cool. And when I go in there, I feel like I'm part of this cool group that's in there, right? So how do we achieve that sort of a look? And so, you know, I always tend to discount it a little bit because the Apple store costs about $500,000, and my clients never have that kind of money. But you try to sort of develop something with them that they can handle. The first thing that happens when you're doing a store is you have to figure out how are you going to get noticed. And what I see happen often is people will do this killer website, and they'll do great promotion, and they'll do wonderful advertising, and they'll do great social media, and they'll drive people to their new store, and they get to the store, and the store looks like hell. The store does not stand up to the advertising and the websites that they've created. And so for me, it's always kind of like, and I don't know if this has happened to you, but you know, I travel fairly often, and I'll go to VRBO, or I'll go to a resort site or something, and you look at all the pretty pictures, and you go, this is it, you know? And you say to your wife, I have found the best spot to go to. And then you get there, and it's a dump, right? And all you want to do is get your money back. Well, you don't want to have that happen. You want to make sure that if you've got this killer site and you're promoting the hell out of it, that when people get there, it stands up, right? You're walking the talk is kind of what it boils down to. What you also want to make sure of is this. Some of the stores that I have been into, the brew stores that I've been into, are on a main street. Some of them are buried in an industrial park, right? It matters more on the main street than it does in the industrial park, but you want people to drive by the front of your store and immediately recognize what it is you're doing there. I mean, if you've got some kind of a name up there that just says brew or homebrew, what are you doing? I mean, nobody knows what you're doing except the people that are coming there specifically because you drove them there. They get it. But you've already got them. What you're trying to do with a storefront sign, what you're trying to do with storefront windows, is get that extra person every day who comes in. And it may not be the person who's driving by that wants to come in. It may be their best friend that's going in the beer business that you go, I know a place. They're over by my office. They're on the way to my office. This is where you find them. How do you do that? How do you capture people's attention? If you're in a strip center, it's a little tough sometimes. They tell you what you can do. If you're in an independent building or you're downtown, you can do a little more. It starts with the sign. And so you want to make sure that you have a good-looking sign that is lit that tells people exactly what you do. It has a tagline. It has an extra little bit of copy that says, we sell homebrew equipment, somehow or another. If you just put up a name and it's somewhat nebulous, you're going to go nowhere fast. You're not going to get that extra customer. Two. If you have windows, display windows, that can get seen by the general public, whether it's drive-by, walk-by, okay, then you want to make sure you maximize the use of those windows. How do you do that? I mean, it's not like you can put cans of beer in the window. Nobody's going to get it. It's not like you can necessarily just put brew pots in the window. Nobody's going to get it. And if you've got drive-by, it's even tougher to do that. And so what you really want to do if you have windows is create a back wall, so that people don't look into the store. Yeah, I know everybody wants to look into the store. Believe me, when they're driving by, they don't look into the store. What you want to do is have graphics in that window that people really, really, really see. And they instantly associate what's happening in those graphics with what's happening in that store, and they remember it. Best way to do it? One of two. You build a wall, you get a light box, you put in a backlighted transparency that sings with a compelling image that drives people into the store. And I'll talk about that more in just a little while. The people that do this the best, believe it or not, Victoria's Secret does a great job of this. They used to be mannequin-driven. Now when you walk by their stores, whether it's in the mall or it's a freestanding building, and you look at the windows, and they have giant graphics, okay? And they capture the female's attention, and they definitely capture the men's attention as well. But everybody knows what they're selling when you drive by there. Getting windows done, other than graphics, is always a challenge. And people always say to me, who can help me merchandise my windows? Who can do them? I say, you know what, it used to be a business. And when I first started doing this 30-odd years ago, there were people all over the place that you could hire to do your windows and merchandise your store. That business is gone. It doesn't exist. And so you can go to Craigslist and you can find somebody who can help do the windows. But for the most part, You go to a mall, you find some great windows, you walk into the store and you say, who did your windows? And you try to hire a freelance to do the work for you. But I can't emphasize how much that storefront sign, the tagline, and the windows are going to drive people in. And the windows, if you're lucky, will not only drive people in, but when you have your existing redundant customers who are coming in for a packet of yeast and they see what's in the window and you've got something new, they're going to be interested in that as long as you're telling the correct story. When people get into the stores, you don't want to knock them over with product the second they walk in. You know, they've traveled, they've found a place to park, they walk in the door. You don't want merch in their face. You know, they should decompress, and I sort of call it a decompression foyer. So leave a little bit of breathing room before they get in there, before you hit them immediately with merchandise. Create a 6 foot by 6 foot, an 8 foot by 8 foot opening there where they can just sort of walk in, breathe a sigh of relief, look around the store a little bit before they move on. Most of your people, when you think about laying out the store, are going to travel to the right. And so what you want to do is make sure you've got merch to the right. And I've walked into a couple of stores lately where there was an immediate tasting room to the right. You know, sometimes it's architecturally driven. I mean, you have to take what you get. If you can start from scratch, though, you don't want the tasting room right there. You want merchandise right there. That's where everybody walks. And they're going to traverse that store from the right to the left. They're going to make typically a big circle, depending upon how you drive the traffic. And so what I tend to try to do, depending on what the client wants architecturally, is you've got merch, and then towards the back of the store, in the very back of the store, you've got something that drives people all the way through, right? So typically, you're definitely going to have what I call the milk and eggs, okay? If you go into any store, Ralph's, Vaughn's, whatever, the milk and eggs are in the back. Everybody has to go to the back to get their commodities. So they put it back there. Well, you have certain commodities that should go in the back of the store. I also usually put a video back there so people are driven back to see what's going on all the way in the back of the store. We did a store a few years ago, been a little while. It's in Coronado, which is an island across the way here. And it was a sporting goods store, and I called it a cigar store. It was about 15 feet wide, and it was 90 feet deep. So we built offices and warehouse way at the back, and that brought me up to about 75 feet. And I put this giant television set on the very, very back wall, so you could see it as you walked in, and it would sort of drive you to the back. It was on a main drag. And I called this guy up about a month after he opened, and I said, so how's it going? And while we're talking, I could hear people honking. And it was just sort of every couple of minutes, people would be honking. And I said, what's that honking? And he goes, well, there's a red light not too far up from where my store is. And so when people stop at the red light, there's always somebody who starts watching the TV set inside my store, right? Off they go. So in any event, I mean, towards the back of the store, I tend to put things. Clearly, the warehouse goes back there if at all possible. If you've got offices, they go out the back. If you've got a brewing room, I like to have things like that exposed. Okay, we did a store for Orange County Choppers. I don't know if you remember Orange County Choppers. I don't know if it's still on TV anymore. It was the family of people who couldn't get along very well. And we moved them from a 10,000 square foot store in Stewart, New York, I think it was, to this gigantic 50,000 square foot store, something immense. And that was a scene. I mean, talking about people arguing, dysfunctional families, that was, oof. But, you know, and literally about every 20 minutes they would take off and they would go lift weights, right? It's like, then they'd come back after lifting weights. But anyways, they had this 10,000 square foot store and then they had this garage. And when you were watching it on TV, you could watch what was happening in the garage. If you were in the store, you couldn't. So now we get this gigantic space that the city of New York was, or the state of New York was paying for mostly. And so we built a room with bleachers looking into the garage so people could sit there and watch the show. And it was packed. Now, with brewery, you know, you don't do stuff all day long. But I think at the same time, if you've got a good-looking back room that's got brewery equipment and you're brewing beer, then people should be able to see it. You know, and not just a door that's open, there should be a window of some kind. Likewise, the tasting room, you know, in particular, if you combine it with a classroom, should be somewhere towards the back. Because what you're really trying to do is those are destinations. You know, you want people to know that they exist, particularly the classroom. But you want people to look at the merchandise. And I'm going to give you a better example of that. Are many people here from San Diego? Not that many. If you have time while you're in town, in Pacific Beach, which from here is about a 15-minute drive, there is a store called Great News. And so Great News started off as a gift shop. And the guy who owned it always wanted to have a foodie shop before there was foodie shops. And eventually, through a series of circumstances, he was able to take over a space. And in the back of this, it's probably about an 8,000-square-foot store, he built a 3,000-square-foot kitchen. And it was a teaching kitchen. And in the front of the store is all merch. Okay, so to get to the kitchen, you've got to wander through this entire store. He is now the most successful school for teaching the general public, probably in the country. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. And people come from all over the country to go get learn how to cook Thai or cook kosher or whatever it is. But in order to get to the classroom, they've got to go through the entire store. And that's something similar that you want to do. Same thing with the brew, with the pub. You know, if you're creating some kind of a tasting room, and depending upon what you're doing and whether or not it's going to be like a bar or like a pub or whether people can sit down, I mean, if you can put it on the floor, you know, much like they do at Barnes & Noble's, where there's a coffee shop right in the middle of everything, then for gosh sakes, do it, you know, because what it does is it creates community inside of your store. You know, it gives people a place to sit and congregate and talk. It gives people who are seriously interested in a bigger job a place for the salesperson to sit down with them and really kind of help them lay out what they're doing in their garage or their house or whatever it is that they're doing. But you try to get that onto the sales floor as well. But in any event, all of this has to get laid out in a way that allows the traffic flow to flow, okay? To do so in a way that's not disruptive. And sometimes that takes, you know, sitting down with somebody like me that, you know, kind of understands traffic flow and how it works at the same time as you, who really knows how your customer is going to react, and developing what that traffic flow is going to be. And it absolutely impacts sales. If you're in a dinky little store, all of this is out the window, okay? Because you're so small, it doesn't really matter. You know, people are going to find everything that's in the store, no matter what. The elements that go into a store, and I'm just going to burn through this relatively quickly. You know, you start with something that seems a little bit innocuous, but the flooring, okay? And so if you can imagine having this carpet in your store and what it would do to the customers that walk in, you kind of see what I mean. You know, we're not in the business of selling flooring. And so what you want is something that is not a distraction. And so if it's left to me, I usually encourage people just to go with the concrete floor. You know, it's one of my favorites. It's not horribly expensive. It's not horribly expensive to maintain. You can clear coat it. You can stain it. You can, you know, go over the. There's all kinds of things. You can inlay logos into it. You know, and it probably ranges here in San Diego. It's anywhere from about $4 a square foot up to about $8, depending upon what it is you're going to do. Versus carpet, which is cheap. I mean, carpet can be $1 to $2 a square foot. But concrete's one of my favorites. Wood is one of my favorites. Vinyl wood, if you have a flat enough floor, is a great product. Okay, it's called premium vinyl. It's a killer product. But what I'm here to tell you is I want you to pay attention to it, because if you just have a gray, commercial-grade carpet that maybe came with the space, get rid of it, because it's not doing you any favors. It's not adding one thing to the look of the store, and the floor is important. People do notice it. What becomes more important is the ceiling, the lighting. Okay, the lighting will create more sales in your store than any other singular thing, period. Okay, and when somebody, you know, and I'll give you a cue, for instance. I got a phone call from a relatively large surf sports shop up in Encinitas that I've been doing business with for a lot of years yesterday. And she said, look, could you come on up here? The dressing room lights are awful. And I said, no kidding. I've been telling you this for like, you know, 10 years. She goes, and I want a mirror that makes people look thinner. I said, I don't know about that. So she goes, no, I mean, some of these girls come away crying. They put on a bikini and they come away crying. I said, well, you might, you know, direct them some other way, but don't put a skinny mirror in there for them. But in any event, I went and looked at their light bulbs, and they had these like warm fluorescent lights, and there's other light bulbs you can get for a dressing that are much more flattering than that. And so we're going to make that change. And my suspicion is, because 60% of the decisions to buy clothing are made in the dressing room, she'll probably increase sales by 10% by changing her light bulbs. And typically what happens with somebody who's going into a relatively low-budget store design is they'll walk in, and it'll be a strip center or Main Street sort of location, and there'll be a drop ceiling like this, and there'll be some fluorescent lights with a crackle finish underneath them. And that's the lighting, and they don't touch it. They don't change it a bit. So forget about LEDs or forget about natural lighting or track. They just go, this is it. I'm going to live with it. I'm going to spend my money elsewhere. And it's probably one of the worst things that they can do. And here's why. For the most part, in a retail environment, you have two kinds of lights. So you've got general lighting and you have display lighting, right? And so what a lighting person does is they balance the two. And if all you wind up with is general lighting, kind of like what we have in here, then it's like talking to somebody who's talking in a monotone. You just get bored out of your guts, okay? And what you need is the display lighting to punctuate the displays, to create hotspots, to create a little bit of a wow factor. And you want them, for the most part, to be adjustable. So you can go into a high-end store and they'll have all recessed lighting, and even the lighting like you see up here that's recessed in will be adjustable, and so forth. It costs you a bloody fortune. For the most part, what you want is this combination of general lighting, which can be fluorescence with a diffuser. These light bulbs can now get changed out to LEDs, okay? Color rendition index is pretty good. If you've got a tall ceiling, like an open ceiling, which is my favorite, so it looks more like a factory, then you can go to a pendant light. So a pendant light, if you can picture a Home Depot light, but smaller, so it's sort of an industrial-looking light, there's LED fixtures that will fit up into that. They work great. And then you hang track. And what happens when you go to hang the track, depending upon who you talk to, you can get sort of creamed on the price. And I'm going to punctuate all these conversations with price, because I'm always balancing budget. You know, and it doesn't matter who comes to me, they've always got a budget. You know, and they always lie about it one way or the other, like I care, right? they either tell me they have more, or they tell me they have less, okay, which puts me in a quandary, because I don't know whether to give them a Volkswagen or a Cadillac, right? But in any event, you've got these pendant lights, and if you're in an open ceiling, and those hang maybe on 12-foot centers. And then in between that, you run your track lights, which usually go, you know, you pull them in 5 feet from the wall, you do a run, track is cheap, you run it around the perimeter of the store, and then depending on how wide the store is, you go about every 10 feet with another track, right? And that should cover you. And with the lights, you know, it can be anywhere from every 4 feet to every 6 feet, depending. Sometimes it's every 2 feet. But the trick is this, two things. One, you buy the fixtures right so you can afford to do this. And so a pendant fixture can be $90 or it can be $600, okay? The bulb is what's important, really. A track fixture, same thing. I mean, you can buy a, quote, LED track fixture, you know, which is really the lighting company's way of trying to suck you into buying this expensive fixture, or you can buy a $17 Home Depot track lamp and put in a great LED bulb, okay? And that's what we do for the most part. You know, you can buy a fixture for $17. The bulbs are the key, though. And so with these LED bulbs, if that's the direction you're going, the bad news is what you need is spotlights. And so you can go to Costco and you can get an LED bulb for about $14, but a spot one's $44. And so all of a sudden you have to start to weigh, what am I going to do here? Am I going with halogens that are $5, or am I going with LED spots that are $40? How long is it going to take you to really cross over? But the biggest issue is this. The lights are cheap. You know, you come to me, you have a 2,000 square foot store, depending upon what we use, I can probably provide all the lights for a couple of grand. It's the electricians that kill you. And so every time I get a bill from an electrician across the country, doesn't matter where it is, doesn't matter how well I know him, I get the bill from the electrician and I call my son and I say, I shouldn't have sent you to Loyola, I should have sent you to electrician school. Every time, okay? It's just off the charts. And so as you're designing this and as you're talking to your lighting designer, you have to say, look, what's it going to cost to get all this stuff installed as well? So you have to do it in concert with some kind of electrical contractor. The point of sale, to me, is the kitchen, okay? It's where everybody really gathers at some point, okay? You may have people traversing the entire store, but the kitchen is where everybody kind of comes together, and that should happen at the point of sale. And what we've been doing with a lot of our stores now, not just your kinds of stores, is one, we either put it in the center, okay, which is great if you have enough room because you really need something down the center of this circle or this rectangle to hide all the crap that's happening on the other side of the counter, right? If you don't have something in the middle, you see the backs of all these counters and cases, it always looks like hell. Well, that means you've got something that's 13 feet wide, right? It's big. If you put it against the wall, you can stick out, you know, 5 feet plus the counter, okay, and you're in pretty good shape. But we include the point of sale, you know, a cabinet for the point of sale. If you think you're going to get busy enough, then we make it available for multiple points of sale because you just don't want people waiting in line. I mean, nobody's happy about waiting in line to buy stuff. A lot of people just want to be in and out. We put in showcases so that they can do impulse buys and or there's certain things that you may want to have in a case that you can explain. And so adjacent to the POS, we put in showcases. We may have some point of sale items, some impulse items that are exposed. It's not my favorite thing. You know, I do bike stores occasionally and they always want to have all these product protein bars and so forth around the counter. It just makes a huge mess, but you can certainly do that. On the back counter, we try not to merch. It's usually too far away from the customer. It's really more of a branding opportunity. Oftentimes we'll put up a graphic, a logo, maybe a video. It reinforces your brand. But lastly, and we've been doing more of this, and we got this sort of from Apple, but we create call it a genius bar, much like Apple, okay? But it's a place where people can sit down close to the front counter and talk about their issues. They can talk about the layout of their brewery in their house. They can go through a web kiosk and look at your website with a salesperson and sit down at a stool and really take their time to either, one, discern what kind of a problem they're having with their existing equipment, or two, to buy new equipment, to do some design work, so forth. But the counter becomes important, and so I'm going to encourage you to pay some attention to that. And when it comes to pricing of that, your options are really two. Really, they're just two. One is, there's lots of counters you can buy off of any fixture website in the country. You go online, you type in counters, there's going to be 50 people who pop up. They're all selling the same counters. They all come from China. They're all pretty okay. You know, they're not bad. Your colors are limited to any color you want, as long as it's black, white, gray, maple. Other than that, you have to go to custom. And when you go to custom, then you're either in there for micas or wood veneers. Somebody's going to make it for you, and it's not a little bit more expensive. It's a lot more expensive. You know, a counter is $200 from China, and it's an easy $1,000 if it's custom made locally. Okay? But once again, I encourage my customers, if you're going to invest some money, this may be the best place to do so. The displays around the perimeter of the store tell stories, and they tell individual stories. And it might be a book story, and it might be a video story, and it might be an equipment story, and it might even be a clothing story, and so forth. If you have long walls like this that just have shelving, okay, and from what I've seen, a lot of the shelving, the stores that I've been into, a lot of the time it's funky shelving. It's like warehouse shelving and stuff. It's just sort of piled on top of it. It doesn't create the story. There's no texture to the wall. And that's what you're trying to do. And so, for the most part, we'll use a variety of fixtures. So, for instance, we might go with a section of slat wall, what I call an AMWA. It's a box. Okay, so the box might be 8 feet tall, 4 feet wide. It's self-lit. It's got slat wall in the back or standards in the back. And it tells a real specific story. We might go with gondolas. I call them 7-Eleven gondolas, but it's just your typical gondolas. But we dial them up. You know, what most people don't realize is you don't need to buy that sort of champagne-colored gondola they have at 7-Eleven. You can get colored shelves. You can get colored back panels. For the most part, it's either the same price or not much more to dial them up and make a little bit nicer. So the context I'm trying to give you here is, as you look at a wall, you want a 4-foot story, a 4-foot story, a 6-foot story, a 10-foot story that breaks the store up into sections so people, not only the customer, but also your employees, can look at that space, figure out exactly what they're trying to buy within that space. They can go through that particular story, and it makes it easier for your client, for your employees, to merchandise the space. In particular, if you start to have multiple stores, it makes it much easier for you to say, here's what you're going to do with that section. Here's the planogram for doing that, right? And at the same time, because you have sectioned off the walls, it gives you an opportunity to do signage, wayfinding signage throughout that explains what each one of those sections does. The breakup on those walls, and I'll talk about graphics more in a little while, is this. And everybody hates to hear this, but when you have a wall that's long and it's full of just merch, you really need to break it up. And you need to break it up with graphics. There's got to be some negative space. There's got to be something compelling. There's got to be something interesting that sort of takes them out of the merchandise mode and says, this is really what I'm here for. You know, I'm really in the beer-making business. What is that all about? Okay? There's restaurants in Pacific Beach by my office. It's called The Fishery. And they took over an old Beacons building that was a mess. And they gutted it, and they put in the back half is their wholesale fish business. She don't want to drive by at the wrong time in the morning. And the front half is this restaurant, this award-winning restaurant called The Fishery. And the decor is open ceiling, concrete floors, really nice colors, great showcases full of fish. But on the walls, they have these old pictures of guys fishing, for the most part men fishing, tuna, big halibut, sharks, I mean, you name it, and they're big, and they're all in black and white, and I've looked at every one of them, and every single time in there, I go in there, I look at them more, and as I watch people eating, they're looking at them more, and I swear I think people come there just to look at the pictures, and they're even in the bathrooms, okay? It's a compelling image. When Nike opened their first Nike Town, it was in Chicago. And, you know, being in my business, we all heard about this incredible store that was in Chicago, right? So I was in Chicago. So off I go to the store, and I walk in, and the store was just fabulous. The first Nike Town was just, like, off the charts. and the graphics were great, but I walked into the kids' shoe department, and there was this picture on the wall of this little black kid, about, could have been 3 years old, and he's wearing soccer shorts that are like down past his knees. He's got on a little jersey, and he's got on a little hat, and he's wearing his dad's Michael Jordan's, right? And he's kicking a soccer ball. And he's got 1 foot off the ground and 1 foot way too high up in the air, like he's going to fall over backwards. And I saw this picture 15, 20 years ago, and I still remember it. Okay? It was a compelling image. And so as we break up the store, you want to have compelling images like that in there. It will differentiate you from everybody else. So back to the walls. Texture. Slat wall, grids, gondolas, amois, different types of fixtures. And certainly you guys have specialty stuff. You got bins. You got, you know, things for the ingredients. I understand that part. Fit them in there, okay? And then sign them all so that when people traverse the store, they understand where things are, and it's easy to find them. And as they come back again and in, they can find them easily, you know, so forth. They know where to go. The floor fixtures are kind of similar, okay? I mean, clearly, if you have a big enough store, you need probably gondolas. You know, gondolas wind up being the most cost-effective way to merchandise, you know? And again, and when I say gondolas, I mean like 7-Eleven pegboard gondolas. Once again, you can change them out. You can color them up. You can change the backs. You can certainly make them look more interesting. You can make sure you don't do long, long runs. You can make sure you just go maybe 8 feet with two end caps, create a little space, do another one because the end caps sell more than anything else. Just don't make them too tall. You know, I go into these stores and the gondolas are 7 feet tall. There's merchandise on top. And you feel like you're weaving through a forest to try to get to anything. You know, so as much as you can, try to keep your levels down to about 5 feet so people can see throughout the store. Yeah, you're going to lose a little bit of merchandising space, but sometimes less is more. You know, I mean, you really want to pick up people who enjoy going through the store, and when they've got those tall aisles, they really just don't. I mean, it's just not as great of a customer experience as it is when you can see throughout. But usually for me on the sales floor, I wind up with gondolas. I use tables, and the tables are on wheels, and they're rectangular and they're round, and you put specialty items on there. It might even be that you put books on there, in some cases, face up. If you've got something that's happening that's hot, you may have that right at the front door, a round table, hot display. You know, this is the latest and greatest, so forth. I mean, you find a use for tables. I also will take slat wall fixtures, and we'll configure them into H's or pinwheels or that sort of a thing, put them on wheels. Once again, they're great for hooks, they're great for shelves. It tells a different story. You've got multiple sides to them. Each side can tell a story. Great way to display things. And so you sort of mix it up on the sales floor, but again, as much as you can, you put them on wheels. And that way you can change up the look of the store. Quickly, how do you buy this stuff? Any of these displays can be bought out of catalogs other than the custom stuff. Okay? And sometimes you can buy used, good luck. The problem with the used stuff is you lose sort of that cohesive look. Okay? You've got stuff, you know, a little bit from an old penny store, a little bit from an old May Company store. It can be like a mess, okay? Sometimes you can use fixtures that are sort of antique-looking. You know, I've seen some great stores where they simply went to antique stores, or they went to prop stores, and they got killer stuff. Sometimes you can go to IKEA and buy a few things as well. But for the most part, it's tough to buy stuff that's not new and keep the store looking cohesive throughout. And it's tough to do a really killer store without doing some custom work with at least a local cabinet maker giving you a hand to do so. We talked about graphics. What I'm going to talk to you about now is how to buy them and how to mount them a little bit. There are, in various industries, different sources that specifically sell imagery that has to do with that particular industry. I don't know if there is for the beer market. I don't know if you can find old pictures of brewery, old pictures of brewmasters, that sort of a thing that's through a specific website. There may be even something through the industry. On the other hand, you can go to the copyright-free sites like Shutterstock, like Getty, and so forth, and you're going to find all kinds of stuff. You pay for it. Okay? And what you have to be careful about is two things. One, with some of these sites, when you buy the imagery and you plan to blow it up, they only sell it to you in sort of a low resolution. So when you blow it up, it pixelates and it doesn't look so great. You have to pay more to get the high res. Pay more. Get the high res. Two, some of them have a license fee for commercial. So you got to read the fine print. And it may say to you, you buy from us, yeah, you can use it for commercial purposes, but you have to pay the license fee of $100 every year, right? And you have 20 pictures in your store, it starts to add up, okay? So how are you going to get caught? I don't know, but I had one client who got caught and it cost him a couple of $1,000. So word of the wise, be careful. But for the most part, You can start off with a company like Shutterstock, read their fine print, and start to go through the various imagery, and you'll start to get an idea of what I have in mind. And just type in beer making, so forth. The next issue for me really has more to do with videos. And a lot of my customers kind of consider them a distraction. Not a lot. Some of my customers consider them a distraction. In particular for me, in this kind of a business that has a how-to aspect to it, that has the possibility of showing YouTubes and showing videos that you might be selling and showing, you know, old movies or, you know, that sort of a thing. Throughout the store, you have an opportunity to put a video screen, okay, of some kind. So what are you going to put on it and where should it go? For me, I like something having in the back of the store as a bit of a draw. I like something having in the classroom as well as outside the classroom. So if you've got a class, what you want to be able to show people is here's what happens when you go to the class. And so you show in that outside video the classroom in motion. Okay, you show the teaching. So they can sit there and watch it, but they want to come back to see more of it. You probably have a video by the front counter, and it, once again, it's just adding to sort of that community at the counter. It gives people something to talk about. So I just go with smart screens. You don't buy anything fancy. You go down to Best Buy or Target and get the best deal, and you go from there. But they need to be smart screens so that you can plug in. So you can, you know, plug in your computer, and you can generate the types of imagery that you want to on it as well. Okay. One other thing that's kind of fun inside of a store like this is props. And so the props could be old equipment, the props could be old uniforms, props could be any kind of equipment that sort of says beer, that's older, that, you know, what we call them, Disney calls them weenies. I mean, it's a big thing inside the store that everybody has to look at. So, for instance, I've done authenticated baseball merchandise, football, basketball, so forth, stores. And I remember one time we got Babe Ruth's bat. I mean, thousands of people came to see this bat. We just rented it for a little while. We had Muhammad Ali's robe that he had won, in the Liston fight. People came from all over the place to see this thing. And so you're not going to get that kind of stuff, but you can certainly add to the authenticity of the store by having things like that in the store that people want to look at, want to touch, want to be around. The other things are this. And I didn't see this in the stores, and I was kind of surprised, and there must be in other stores. What you're trying to do is breed loyalty amongst your customers, you know, and you've got all these people who are making beer, and I'm sure some of them are bottling it, and some of them are putting maybe even in cans, and some of them are really proud of their work, and some of them are getting awards, and there really should be a customer wall that really flatters and presents your customers, okay, on a regular basis, so they get recognized. So you can certainly do this with social media, and you can certainly do this on your website, but inside the store, there should be, let's call it a trophy wall, you know, a customer wall, where people can really say, hey, can I get on your trophy wall? Of course, you know, let's add you here. If you have a customer that's on your wall, why would they shop anywhere else, for God's sake? You know, you're recognizing them. Put it in there. Quick word on the pub room, tasting room. I think you have to make a decision on exactly what it's going to be. I mean, one, is it just part of the classroom? Two, is it really part of the store? I'm going to say licensing aside, because I'm sure the licensing is different every place you go. But if it were me and I had the license and I could pull it off, then I would make it more like a pub. You know, I would really make it someplace that felt like a pub, a bar, a nice one, comfortable seating, great-looking bar, great signs behind it, mirror, glasses. I mean, the whole nine yards. I mean, make it feel like someplace where you can come on in and sit down and really relax and, you know, buy some beer and sit and talk to their friends and want to come back. It can be that kind of a gathering places. You can rent it out, have events, do that whole sort of a thing. But make it an important part of the store. Don't make it an afterthought. Couple of other things. Books are probably one of your least profitable areas, maybe, I would think. You probably don't sell that many of them, but people come and buy them. And when they buy them, I prefer to see them not standing there looking at them all the time. And I prefer to see them not all in one spot. And so one of my favorite stores locally is called Patagonia. You know, they've got a big website and so forth, but they've got killer stores. And they have a little store up in Cardiff. And in one corner, they've got a video playing, and they've got a bunch of books, and they've got a couple of really comfortable chairs. And I don't go in there that I don't sit down in those chairs for a little while and read some books. Okay? And so provide that kind of extra space for your customers. It's something they'll absolutely appreciate. Web kiosks are another sort of an interesting topic. Some of my customers take advantage of them. Some of them don't. I'm going to encourage you to do that. If you've got a website, particularly if it's a good one, you should have some place, maybe multiple places in the store where people can go through your website. It's a tool not only for your customers but for your salespeople to be able to go to the site and say, look, we have this here, but here's all the ones that we sell. We'll be happy to ship it to you. We can have it here in a couple of days. But it should be something that they can go through and look at your products. If you have vendors that have sites that you can use, okay, that are not going to impact your own site, those should be on there as well. If there's anything to do with space planning or that sort of a thing that's on the site, that should be in there as well. And lastly, it should be some kind of an email sign-up so you can keep in touch with these people. Okay? But I'm going to encourage you to have some kind of a website kiosk. There should be something up at the Genius Bar or up at the counter, maybe even something towards the back of the room or in the library section. Quickly, two other things. Music is more important than people think, okay? And music is demographically driven, and the demographic that drives it is not the people that work for you. Okay? So figure out who your customer is, figure out what kind of a station to listen to, and get that kind of music, and it should be playing lightly in the background all the time, and you should have it. You don't need an expensive speaker system, but just something that sort of permeates the room. Keeps your employees happier, and it keeps your customers much happier, and they will stay in the room much, much longer. Now, let me talk to you quickly about, yeah, I'm running out of time here, about process a little bit, as far as design is concerned, then I'll throw it up in the questions. Somebody comes to me and says, either I'm thinking about opening up a store, or I have signed a lease, right? And I'm going to open up a store, and I need help with the design. So the first question is, where is it? And if it's local, I'll usually go take a look. If it's not local, I'll have them send me some pictures. If it's local and I go take a look, and it's what I call a kiss of death location, my first question is, have you signed the lease? Right? If they have signed the lease, I just say, what a great location. If they have not signed the lease, I say, this is a really kiss-adjust location. Let's go elsewhere, okay, and try to talk them out of it. And sometimes you can't because they're newbies and they couldn't get a lease anywhere else, and so they just go. But in any event, we look at the space, we measure the space, we take pictures of the space, and what I try to determine first is, what do you want it to look like other than the Apple Store, right? What are we trying to achieve here? And for the most part, everybody has... I don't want to say champagne taste, but there's certain elements that they want to have in the store, and they never have enough money to do it. So I'll say, how much money do you have? And they say, what do you mean? And they'll say, well, you have a couple of budgets. One's for the front of the store. You got to pay for a front sign one way or another. That could be anywhere from, $1,000 to $5,000, depending. Two, you've got to pay for the construction work, right? If you've got to build any walls, put down any flooring, change any electric, we have a budget for that. Three, we've got a budget for the fixtures and displays, right, where I have the most flexibility. And four, we have a graphics video budget. So why don't we figure out what we have? Because you have two things here. You have must-haves and you have want-to-haves. You got to have a sign. And you're going to need some flooring. And we really need to fix up the lights. And you've got to build some walls for the warehouse, the tasting room, the classroom, blah, blah. So let's see generatively what that's going to come to. And so we do that, and I say, look, typically we need to get a general contractor on the team here as quickly as possible to get some numbers because I don't know what things cost necessarily in Minnesota, And we try to find that number. And so if their overall budget is, pick a number, 50 grand, right? We'll say, okay, you've got 5 for the sign, you've got 20 for the interior construction, you've got 30 left. So that 30 is going to cover the fixtures and the graphics and the TVs, okay? Now, 50 can be a pretty high number. I have people come to me and say, I have $10,000. And I say, well, you should probably invest in a certificate of deposit and save your money, right? But somebody comes to me and says they have $20,000 or $30,000. My job is really to say, okay, let's figure out what things are going to cost. Let's sit down and figure out how to build this stuff without having to pull a general contractor in because they're going to eat up a bunch of your profit. Let's just do it with a handyman. Let's design the fixtures to fit. And so that's... In some cases, that's one of the most important things that I do. And then I go through, what do you want it to look like? And we really develop a theme. Is it going to look rustic? Is it going to look Italian modern? Is it going to look like a cowboy store? I mean, what is it going to look like? What's your comfort level? And what's your customer's comfort level, right? And then my job is to take the budget and the look and the product and the demographic and to blend it together to come up with a plan. And so typically we do a floor plan. We send it out, and I say, your job is to tell me what you love and you hate, and we go through that love-hate process. We may do it 10 times to get to a floor plan. And once we have the floor plan, we stand it up in 3D so we can see what it's going to look like. And we go through that same permutation process. And when that's done, we go through the pricing. And at that point, I'm pretty close on the pricing. And we value engineer if we need to. You know. And sometimes the contractor comes out and says, everything's great, but you've got this pipe here in the middle of this wall that we didn't know about. Right? And so there's something that we just couldn't realize. And over the course of typically 2 to 4 weeks, you develop a plan that is workable. And if you can, you try to do it in such a way that it doesn't have to go to an architect, because that's a whole other layer of costs, right, to get a permit, and it increases your time. So, you know, you figure if you have the time, you give yourself 2 to 3 weeks to 4 weeks for design. You give yourself another week to get the thing bid. Depending upon the construction levels, most small stores, you might need 3 weeks to get it built. Fixtures take about a month. All of this overlaps, and so if the stars align and everybody can agree, you've got a 2 to 3 month process to get the whole thing done. That being said, I've done it in a week, and I've done it in 6 months, okay? And there's variables that come into play. The main thing you have to do is this. I call it the Zen of store building, very California. So you just have to flow with it. I mean, shit's going to happen. You know, something goes wrong all the time, okay? If it can go wrong, it'll absolutely go wrong. And it won't have anything to do with anybody. It's just stuff goes wrong. So that's how you try to do it. And part of my job winds up being holding people's hands, which is fine. The design fees, so you know, for a guy like me, it's $2,000 to $6,000. If it's a big, big job, it can be a little bit more. Architect, you know, usually I can work on the architect and say, look, you're not doing any design work. I mean, all you're doing is taking my CAD drawings and putting notes on them locally and some structural details and so forth. So I can usually get that cost pretty far down. The construction cost, who knows? You know, it depends what you want to do. Couple of things, then I'll close and I'll open for questions. The main thing you need to say to yourself on a regular basis is this. What makes my store so darn special? Okay? And darn's a nice way of putting it. You have to be different than everybody else. If you're the same as everybody else, you don't have much really going for you. And so to me, it's products. Okay, so you should, as much as you can, I mean, clearly you've got a lot of the same vendors, you're going to have a lot of the same stuff everybody else has, you try to have some stuff that's unique if you can find it, right? Two, pricing. I mean, you've got to be competitive, you know, and not only you have to be competitive with other stores, but you have to be competitive with what's online. And the way people are selling now with no shipping charges, how the hell they do that, I don't know, it's tougher, okay? And so keeping in mind, but a lot of people will pay for a local community-driven store, you still have to keep in mind that if you are 20, 30, 40% higher than somebody who's online, you're going to have to figure out how to kowtow someplace. Three, people are the most important element. I mean, when you talk to anybody about what they like most about the store, if they like the store, it's always the people. If you go to Yelp and you start typing in stores and you start reading the reviews, when somebody's pissed off, they Yelp it. Okay? So you really want to invest in the people. And so, you know, what I mean is this. I mean, it's you get somebody, and one, you want to make sure they understand the product. I mean, they don't want to be a doofus. They need to understand the brewing process, what people need. You train them on a regular basis. That's one track. The other track is, can they sell stuff? I mean, do they get along with people? Are they courteous? Are they fun to be with? Are they humorous? I mean, how many times have you gone to a store where somebody's working there that really doesn't want to be there, and they're arrogant as hell, and they in fact want to be a screenwriter, and they're there until they sell their first script, and that just want to go get another job, man. So make sure your people are trained in the process, the brewing process, as well as in salesmanship. The other is this. I mean, I can tell you this list, you know, get your lights done right, merchandise the store correctly, do your signage, et cetera, et cetera. It's consistency, okay? You have to do this every day. I mean, every day you can't forget. The store's got to be clean. The signs have to be up to date. The displays have to be pulled together properly. The light bulbs can't be out. It's an everyday thing. You have to be consistent because it's easy not to. And part of what happens is I'll walk into a store and somebody will say, looks great. And I'll go, yeah, but the bathroom's a mess or something, you know? They just don't see it anymore. two other things. One is change. And so you want the store to change up. Make sure it doesn't look the same day after day after day after day. I mean, go on in there, move things around, change the displays, change the signage, change the videos that are playing, change the graphic images so people get a new feeling as they come in. And lastly, communication these days is critical. And I'm not a specialist in social media or web design or so forth, but I encourage all of my customers, you have to stay on top. And my kid works for Hurley. Hurley's a surf company owned by Nike. All he does is social media all day long. I mean, I send him to Loyola to become a lawyer or something. He winds up in social media so he can surf every day at Hurley. And he has a great time. I wish I had his job, to be honest with you. But I mean, he does an Instagram for a surf contest in Fiji, and 2 million people read it. Right? 2 million people read it. I mean, their sales are $500 million. They sell trunks and T-shirts, for God's sake. Okay? I mean, social media works. And so if you're not doing it, do it. Okay, if you don't know what to do, you know, if you're somewhat of a dinosaur, find somebody who can do it. Find somebody, you know, I don't want to say younger. I mean, just find somebody smarter that has an interest that can help you with Facebook and your website and your Instagram and all of those things, because it will absolutely drive people into the store and create brand loyalty. Okay? All right, I'm going to stop because I've only got a few minutes left and say questions.
It's still morning, so I'll say good morning. A lot of us here have smaller stores, and we have to stock a lot of stuff on the floor.
Right.
We talked a lot about displays and stories, and that's really good. But how do we deal with having to stock on the floor and provide that same environment?
Yeah, it's always tough. You know, you have a small store, it's really rough. And so really what happens is this. You know, you either palletize it. I mean, it's nice if you can let it get it off the floor just a little bit. Okay, whether it's on a pallet or whether you just make a base, and maybe the base has big wheels on it, and you stack it as need be. If it's not really a stackable item, then you put it on some kind of a shelving unit or that kind of a thing. The biggest issue is really the signage. So once it is stacked, once it's on the floor, you just want to make sure that it doesn't look like you forgot about it, right? That it came in from UPS and you just plonked it there. So make it into a merchandise display, okay? And the best way to do that, the fastest way, is you get these acrylic sign holders, you go to your printer, you print up the sign, and you slide it in. You make sure your logo is on it, make sure the signs look pro, and you explain what it is you're selling. But, you know, you got the same common problem everybody does. It's one thing when you've got a big store, and when you have a small store, it's brutal. You have to come up with other ways to do it, okay? Does that help? Okay. Okay, other questions? Kind of covered everything?
So there's not a lot of competition for what we do. Like, most stores are like 20 miles apart.
Yeah.
If I make my store look nice like a Target, can I charge more? Is there any way that we can quantify how I'm going to get a return on investment?
I wouldn't look at it that way. I really wouldn't. I think it's a scary way to do things. Okay. You know, here where I am, and the stores are, there's a bunch of stores in San Diego, so they really have to be competitive, you know. And if you're out in East Cupcake, you know, it may be that the next store is 20 miles away, and so you might be able to charge a little bit more because you've got different shipping costs and so forth. But, you know, if I'm Joe Blow Brewmaker, the problem is the internet, okay? And so if you can go online and you can buy something with no shipping fees in particular that's 20% below what you're selling it for, it's a problem, right? If you've got commodity items that they're not going to get online, you can certainly charge a little bit more, but if I can drive 20 miles to go buy something at a much lower price, I'm going to do it, and I'm not going to be happy with you. So I would just be careful.
Thanks.
Sure. Okay, other questions?
Kind of a follow-up to that question. Like, we're homebrewers, we're shop owners, we're not store layout people. How do we know that what you're saying we need to do, like, you just basically told him, if you can't afford to do it, don't do it, right? So how do we afford to do it? How do we know that we can afford to do it? How do we know that,
well,
it's going to turn into something that's going to, you know, be beneficial for,
yeah,
our shop?
Look, clearly, you can't – you can read about it, but at the end of the day, you've got to get a consultant or somebody. You know, you got to talk to somebody like me, you know, wherever you live. Where do you live?
San Francisco.
Okay. There's store design guys up there, you know. I mean, you find somebody and you talk to them and you say, here's what I'm after. Now, if your question is return on investment, okay, is it going to work, right? Some things are simple. I mean, you can go to Google and you can type in, what's the return on investment on upgrading my light in my store, okay? And the information they're going to give you may not be right on the money for a small brew store, but they'll give you sort of a general industry overview. But everything I'm telling you today is experiential, right? I mean, I don't study. I mean, I read reports and I read all the magazines and so on and so forth, and I pick it up. I've just been doing this for a long time, you know. And so you need to talk to somebody who's been doing it for a long time, and say, what's the highest and best use? So if you say to me, look, Jeff, I've got this store. I've only got a couple of $1,000. What's the best thing that I can do? My job is to say to you, today, this is the best thing you can do, whether it's lights, whether it's signage, whatever it is. And so it's not a Googleable item. I'm not even sure that you can buy a book about it really exactly. It's like the best thing you can do is get a consultant of some kind, have them come on in and talk to them. And if there's a local fixture company, and there are in the Bay Area, some are great, some are awful. Okay, it depends who you talk to. But you can start there and start with a layout. But that's how I would do it. I go from there. My website's Grand Retail Design, www.grandretaildesign.com. And I'm more than happy you can contact me and I'll answer any questions for you that I can. Okay. Yeah.
I just want to say that was a really good answer to a tough question. I don't know if this is in your area of expertise or not, but maybe based on your experience doing this for a long time and in different retail sections, do you have any comments on like what the hours, you know, that a retail shop like a homebrew shop should be expected to be open? Like, obviously, it's going to be open on the weekends, but you know, can be closed a day or two during the week, or do you need to be open 24 hours?
Yeah, some of this is also demographically driven. Okay, so if you're in a small town community that pretty much shuts down at nighttime, you know, figure out what time it shuts down and shut down at the same time. You know, so I mean, if everybody's out of downtown at 6 o'clock, close. If you're on a busy street with lots of activity and lots of people cruising around, then you may want to stay open a little bit later. You know, and some of this is driven by experience. Okay, so for instance, I was at a store out in Miramar a couple of days ago, and he's in an industrial area. I can guarantee it. Hardly anybody's going to go out there after dinner. They're just not going to do it, right? So he's better off making sure he's open some relatively long hours on the weekends and regular hours during the week. So I'd love to give you a pat answer, but there isn't one. Okay, so I would say you're right, though. I mean, stay open on the weekends because I'm sure a lot of people go out Saturday and Sunday, you know, and shop. You know, keep in mind that if you don't have a lot of competition and you're closed on Sunday, you probably aren't going to lose that much in sales. But if you have lots of competition, you have to stay open, right, because you're going to lose business. And the problem with this business, as I see it, is my suspicion is there's a lot of loyalty to the shop. And so once you lose the customer, it may not be price-driven as much, as long as everybody's relatively competitive. So you really have to work to get the customer and keep the customer, which means you've got to have the hours open to do that. Okay.
Again, you mentioned a lot of like 7 or 8 items, what we can do, but I didn't hear anything about color. Do we stick with our branding color, or do we, it's cheap to put up a coat of paint, I would think, and it kind of freshens things up. So yeah. What would you suggest as neutral? Do we go with our branding colors or some other color that might help them buy?
It depends on your branding colors. So I literally almost never look at branding colors unless I'm doing a team. Okay, so if I've got, you know, the DC Nationals and their colors are really red and black, you know, then I'll use some of that in there, but I tone it down. So let's talk about colors for just a second. I tend to stick with a couple of brights and mostly neutrals, you know, depending upon what you're selling. And a lot of the stuff that you guys are selling is not horribly colorful. Okay, if I'm selling clothing, then I want a background color that is relatively neutral, because if I put in a pink background color and I've got a lime green outfit, it doesn't always work. So for the most part, you go with neutrals, tans, taupes, whites, lighter colors, and then you beef it up. So if you've got the right spot, say behind the books, you might go to a rich blue or even a rich burgundy or a rich green and so forth. The other overlay is the finishes, because it ties into the color. So if the floor is concrete, and let's say it's just gray, you can get away with just about anything. But I like to pull in wood tones, and wood tones always make people feel more comfortable. It doesn't have to be real wood. It doesn't have to be stained wood. You can go with Formica. But you know, you either go with a real light color, like a maple, which is not necessarily my favorite. You go with a relatively deep color, and there's some walnuts out there that are great right now. Or you go with a mixed color, kind of a gold, you know, more of a cherry kind of a color. But I like to mix those. And so typically I'll pull in, you know, call it a cherry with a maple trim, looks fabulous. And then you mate that with some neutrals and a couple of brights, and away you go. But once again, if you don't know what you're doing, it's really inexpensive to hire an interior decorator to say, here's some great colors. It's also not that expensive to call a guy like me and say, here's what the interior decorator said, what do you think, right? And then I may poo-poo it a little bit. But when you look at your branding colors, that overlay should be pulled more into the signage and the graphics than necessarily into. You know, so like today, this guy calls me up from this cowboy shop I'm doing in Texas. He goes, well, Jeff, I really like what you picked out, but I have red in my logo. You think we can put that in? And I said, no. I said, no. He's going, how come? I go, look, it's just too, you know, the color red is just not right for a cowboy clothing store. I'm sorry. You know, it's going to look like hell. So anyway, does that help a little bit? Okay. Okay, more questions?
You talked a bit about location in terms of, you know, where it is on the street or in a city. How about square footage do you find when you are starting a relationship with a client that they're about to sign a lease and you're like, gosh, you should really go with, you know, 20% more square footage, or, you know, is it 200 square foot more? That you find that typically the home brewer or, you know, retail shop owners, you know, thinking on the small side, what do you find the most?
I find that with the newbies in particular, they're taking whatever the hell they can get, okay? But if somebody has a choice, if the rent is low enough, then I encourage them, if the rent is low enough and it's a good location, I encourage them to take the bigger space, right? Because they can grow into it. If the rent is abysmally high, but it's a great location, and this is, but it's small, I say take it. You know, I mean, I will opt for location every time. This particular business, though, if you're good at driving people to the destination, location isn't quite as important in this business as it is for a clothing boutique, okay? Because you can drive people. So it really is sort of a floating scale, but you have to balance in what's the rent, what's the location, how much space do you really need. But I always try to err on the size of bigger, okay? But keep in mind, you do, you know, if you got enough money for a 2,000 square foot store and you get 6,000 square feet of space, you're not going to be able to afford to fill it, okay? So you're going to have to build walls to block everything. So, okay, I hope that helps, but yeah, good. Okay. Okay, anybody else? Okay, I'll stay here for a minute. Thank you all very much. Appreciate your time.